This is the Evolution Eats podcast. Welcome to the show. My name is Noah Katz. I'm joined here by
Emily Stelliotis.
And today we have a wonderful guest from the food space online, I will say.
Yeah, so here we have Emily from Emily Eats. She's a vegan and owner, founder, and blogger at Emily Eats, which is a food, health, and lifestyle blog. Initially, it was really focused on vegan food, and now she's sort of expanding it as she's getting her master's degree in food and nutrition science. And she's also become really interested in sustainable living. She has a bachelor's degree in mass communication and is currently, as I said, working on her master's degree at Colorado State University and is preparing to be a registered dietitian nutritionist. She also has gone from blog to six-figure business in less than 4 years and is focusing on empowering women and other bloggers to make their mark on the food blog space. And we're really excited to have her joining us.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Fantastic. So can you add, correct, repair anything that we've just said about you or continue to explain a little bit about who you are and what you've done?
It was really good summary. But I was like, I wonder if she's going to say my last name because I don't know if she's going to know how to say it. Because since I moved to Colorado a little over a year ago, I've been saying Hebert, but it's really pronounced Hebert, even though it's not spelled like that because it's French and I'm Cajun. So,
I actually heard it pronounced the French way on another like podcast episode you did, and I was like, I don't think I can do that.
That only adds sophistication, so that's fantastic.
Just Hebert, that's it.
Hebert.
It's not, but no, it was a great summary. That's pretty much everything that I do.
Particularly right now you're working on Food Pinstitute, which I think is a very cute name.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about what
I do have to give credit, so three Emilys now, because I have to give credit to my operations officer, Emily, for that name. We were trying to brainstorm what we were going to call it and trying to think of something kind of punny.
Yeah.
And she came up with that, so I give her total credit for
okay.
it.
Okay, cool.
A lot of Emilys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what does the Food Pinstitute do for the audience listening at home?
Yeah, so Food Pinstitute is a four-week program that we're actually in the process of opening doors for our second round right now, but it is a program dedicated to helping, I'm focusing on female food bloggers just because that's my passion is helping other women, grow their food blogs with Pinterest because I know that everyone is really sick of Instagram, and Instagram is never something that I've really prioritized so much because I knew very early on that it wasn't bringing me the traffic and the income that everyone thinks Instagram brings to a blog. So Food Pinstitute teaches bloggers how to use Pinterest strategically to grow their blog and monetize it so that they can, you know, make it into a business.
Fantastic. Yeah, that transformation from just talking about an idea to actually being a name in the space and creating a niche and creating a venue to profitability transforms the person who does that and that company from just someone talking about what they enjoy to actually someone who has, you know, the ability to influence behaviors in some way. And that's great. That's why we're interested in business and interested in people like you, interested in the space in general, because we can now take people with good ideas and, thanks to the internet, empower those people.
Right.
That's who we want to empower.
Yeah, and there isn't anything in this niche. There isn't anything for food bloggers specifically on how to use Pinterest. There are, you know, a multitude of, actually not that many, you know, on how to use Pinterest. But I wanted to make something for food bloggers. I mean, obviously, because I know that's the industry that I know well. It's the industry that I've been in for 4 years. And I just see people spinning their wheels like every single day over Instagram and giving up and thinking that they aren't good enough. And it's because they're focusing on the wrong thing. And I just don't want to see really, really talented people who are pouring all of their energy into something that doesn't work. I don't want to see them give up.
That's a great point. And according to the internet, there are literally 250 million people every day on Pinterest. Mm-hmm. So yeah. You've got the eyeballs, you've got the activity, that growth only seems to be increasing. And if you want to have an impact, my God, that's certainly one way to do it.
Yes.
And of course, there's been a number, this is sort of a little bit in a different topic, but talking about social media, the influence that it has, there's been a lot of pushback on Facebook and products that are owned by Facebook, like Instagram. Mm-hmm. So you're thinking about, well, what platform am I on and who's controlling those platforms? And
yeah, I think, so while I've never like, and I totally understand what you're saying, while I've never been like, I'm going to forego Instagram and not prioritize it because it's owned by Mark Zuckerberg and he sucks, you know, like I've never. But truly, the platform just doesn't do what people think it does.
Right.
I mean, I guess in some industries, like if you're like a fashion model, like Instagram is a really good place for you to be really profitable. Mm-hmm. But for food bloggers, I don't think it does what people think it.
Right.
It doesn't bring the kind of traffic to a website. And at the end of the day, none of us own our Facebook accounts. We don't own our Instagram accounts, right. But we do own websites.
Right.
And I don't think websites are going away anytime soon. So if I can get as many people to my website, and if I can get as many people on my email list, and I do that through them being on my website and signing up for my email list, then I'm going to be in a better place when Instagram inevitably collapses or becomes like, to us, what Facebook is now. Like, right, people our age don't really use Facebook the way that we use Instagram. And one day we probably won't use Instagram the way we are now. And I think people just put too much of their business into it. And it's like, what are you going to do when it all falls apart? And, you know, when I was getting into this 4 years ago, I was working under a full-time blogger. Like, I can credit her for teaching me most of what I know. And I was in charge of doing her social media. And, you know, she was like, when I was first getting started, like we could reach like 30 to 50% of our audience when we posted on Facebook. And she had like over 100,000 likes, wow. Pretty big audience. And then when I started scheduling posts, like over the year and a half that I worked for her, it was like a really good day if we reached 5%.
Wow.
And then that's just because Facebook wants you to advertise to reach the people that they want you to.
Right.
And I don't know if people thought that Instagram wouldn't do the same thing when Facebook bought it. But like, of course, you know, like they want you to buy ads. So don't kid yourself into thinking that Instagram engagement is just going to keep going up and up and up. Like that's not their business model.
No, of course. And really, whether or not to use a platform is about whether the platform mm-hmm. just cares about making money off of you or it's mm-hmm. what people are using to interact with each other. And
right.
There's a lot of passive versus active sort of discrimination there. So yeah. It's important to be somewhere where the people are and people actually care yeah. and want to participate. Otherwise, it's passive scrolling. It's the fact yeah. that on Reddit you have 0.1% of the people making 99% of the content. So online, yeah. To be an influential voice actually mm-hmm. is so important because you're one of the only ones producing the vast majority of content. And so,
right.
so that becomes
which is scary for so little people to be producing the content.
Incredibly
I think
scary.
An interesting point that I want to make, Pinterest has been continuously coming out with changes and I'm not in the business of like ranking the social media platforms by like how good or decent they are. Like at the end of the day, they're
of
all
course.
Businesses, but
of course.
Pinterest has implemented things like they take down posts that promote like anti-vax messages. They've implemented like, if you're scrolling through the app, they have like mindful meditations like within the app. So I think like on the broad, like I do obviously love Pinterest for multiple reasons, but I think as a whole, they're doing a lot more than Facebook to like take down things that are BS. So they've got that going for them.
That's super interesting. Yeah, that's really yeah. interesting insight. Yeah, and I know a couple, shifting gears a little bit, I know someone else who's like a registered dietitian, which mm-hmm. I know you're pursuing, who also has a bachelor's degree in mass communication, sort of mm-hmm. communications. And I think that can be a really good asset that people don't value as much. Like it's, especially, and she's using it now to like get clients, and I think it can be really useful. Do you think that, I mean, your background in that has probably helped you in ways that you didn't even realize, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And I think I know a lot of people who becoming a dietitian is a common second career. And I think that just happens naturally. People get really interested in health and wellness and they decide to go down the track of becoming a dietitian. And a lot of people come from communications. And I am so happy that I will have degrees in different things because it gives me a different set of skills. And I have a lot of, you know, when I was an undergrad, all of my internships and experiences were PR related. So, you know, that built up those skills and now I'm building up like my nutrition knowledge. And yeah, I think it is a really, really valuable skill set to have, especially, you know, one day when I own my private practice, like, yeah, I'm going to have to get clients. And even now just building the blog, like understanding communication and PR and all of that kind of stuff. And I always say, like, you can know all of the nutrition things in the world, but if you don't know how to communicate that with different types of people, different audiences, like, what is it even worth? You know, because no one can really understand what you're saying, or if you're coming at it from like this high horse, or you don't understand how to talk to like a group of college students versus like low income moms, like how are you gonna do that? How are you gonna get people to listen to you?
That's a great point. And so which audience are you focusing on, or are you able to do both with you know 24 hours in a day? Are you going to focus on helping individuals get a better course for their food habits through being a dietitian, or are you going to teach classes? Are you going to keep doing all that in conjunction with the business that helps spread that same message to, you know, the wider world, basically?
I don't know if she's totally sure yet.
Yeah, I still got like 2 years until I'm a dietitian, but I'm starting to get a better idea of exactly what I want to do. And of course, it will evolve and change. But as of now, I think I would like to continue the business as it is, right? Like doing sponsored posts, keeping up the website, you know, keep running Food Pinstitute. Like I have really big goals for that. And then also seeing clients as a dietitian, perhaps doing like group coaching. I'm thinking right now an area that I would like to specialize in or go into, because I see a lot of need for it, is people who are vegan and vegetarian or want to be vegan or vegetarian, but are struggling with their relationship with food, who are struggling with some sort of disordered eating, just unpacking their motivations for wanting to engage in that kind of lifestyle, because I see a ton of need for it in the vegan community where eating disorders are rampant and no one talks about it because, you know, I have an explanation for why I think it's not good, but, you know, being vegan is seen as such a good thing because it's like you're helping the animals, you're helping the earth. Like, who cares what you're eating or if you have an eating disorder, right? Like, you're doing a good thing. And it's like, no, like, you're missing the point. Like, these people are not going to last as vegan if they're miserable and, like, really, really struggling. And then that's not good for anyone. So I think that's where I want to focus.
That's super interesting. Yeah, I didn't even realize that there was, you think there's a strong connection between like people that go vegan and people that are struggling with eating disorders and body images.
100%.
And do you think maybe that has to do with like perfectionism or like extreme?
Yeah, I think that there's I think there's a few reasons or a few things to explain it. And I remember a vegan dietitian friend of mine who, you know, specializes in like anti-diet and intuitive eating and all this shared a research article on vegans and vegetarians, like scientifically shown to have higher rates of eating disorders. So it's not just something that we're seeing anecdotally. But I think perfectionism does have something to do with it. If you're coming at veganism or vegetarianism as a better way to eat, instead of just like, you know, an abundance of plants is like good for me, instead of like, I need the perfect diet. I think if you want to go vegan or vegetarian, it can be seen as a societal, it's an acceptable way to restrict your food, right? It's like, oh, you're vegan. Like you can't have anything at the family dinner, or like, oh, you can't have any thing when you go to the bar and like have like snacks or fries or whatever. So it's like seen as an excusable way for you to say no to foods and restrict because you have an excuse that is seen as really positive. And it can be really, like, I'm vegan, like I'm not saying anything bad about it.
Of course.
But I struggled with some form of disordered eating and dieting before I was vegan, and that didn't change once I became vegan. And I think I did use veganism, or I know I did use veganism as a way to somewhat hide the fact that I was struggling. And that is something that each individual has to figure out on their own journey of like when they finally had the courage to recover, to make a step in that direction, they have to figure out like, why am I doing it? And is it worth it to me, to do these things? And can I do it in a healthful way? Which to me means like having, you know, like vegan burgers and cheese every now and then, and like having, I don't know, all those kind of like vegan fun foods and specialty foods that I didn't let myself have. So I think and just the community can be horrible online. The vegan community is just the worst. So
I was wondering if you'd mention that. But
yeah, at least online.
Yeah, of course. And all communities online can have good and bad aspects. But
yeah.
I was going to mention, it's an integral part. Sort of there's a hidden note here in that if you are struggling with something and that's led you to being a vegan, you're going to immediately then find potentially an embracing community that then encourages that lifestyle. And to be clear, right, there is nothing wrong with being vegan. It's an excellent thing that we promote and have attempted to practice. And we're not against that community either. But if you're going to a situation and you're already struggling with something, and then a community reinforces a behavior that you're doing, you start getting into a feedback loop system, right? So I strongly believe that there are people in all sorts of online communities. And again, this is Noah's opinion here to the public. We're not making business statements, but there are communities that will support virtually any behavior, good or bad, online. Mm-hmm. So when you get in these sort of echo chambers and feedback loops, it's easy to have the best or worst parts of what you're doing encouraged.
Right.
And I think the intersections of those different groups all around the internet and the real world just cause so much armchair conflict. It's distracting from the main points of these things. Okay, there's a person who needs help, or there's a dietary system that is great for the planet and animals.
Mm-hmm.
So so much gets mixed up into that. But at the core of it, that's a great way to think of veganism. And it's important that people get around people who support their choices and make them feel good no matter what. I mean, that's not a bad objective.
Right. And I guess I'll correct myself. The vegan community online that is most visible is horrible. But there are a lot of really cool, and I would want to be associated with this group of cool vegans who don't care what you eat, don't care what size you are, what color you are, how much you make, like any of that kind of stuff. Like you are accepted into veganism no matter what, and who promote like eating a variety of vegan foods, like who don't live by any sort of like abstract or incredibly restrictive food rules, who are really cool. They're just not the ones that you like see headlines about or see like on your trending on YouTube, you know, like those vegans are not the best representation.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we know you're a vegan, and you know, spent years focusing on vegan recipes, so I mean, any community online, you know, you see the extremes.
But the keto community online is an echo chamber. Like the paleo, like all of them are echo chambers, and they all have like people who, you know, take it too far. And you know, so, and I sound like I'm shitting on veganism, like I've been vegan for 4 years, but if you love something, you will criticize it. So
it's almost that anyone who has a presence online and has a community and talks about food creates and engenders another food community. So you suddenly have someone who's only tangentially related to the food community talk about the fact that they occasionally hunt, and now there's an entire new multi-hundred thousand or multi-million person community centered around sustainable hunting and being a carnivore and only eating meat. It's everything creates more of itself, and the fact that it's quite easy to create content and to share ideas like this now is probably a good thing, but can be easily, you know, an amplifying effect to the negative parts.
Yeah, and the extremes seem to go the most viral.
Yeah,
for better or worse.
Yeah,
because
so the carnivore movement is obviously not something that I think is great from a sustainability perspective. And I'm not in the business of telling people that like one way to eat is the healthiest, but I think we can all agree that like eating a carnivore diet is not not good for you.
I think biologically, I mean, we have two food experts, if I may say, in this conversation of three people, and we could pretty firmly say that a balanced diet and that a sort of understanding of humans being evolutionarily omnivores is pretty much scientific fact. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I was actually wondering, in terms of like the RD or like the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, like do they have like a stance on plant-based diets or vegetarianism or veganism?
There's actually a good paper. I can send it to you so you can put the link in the description.
Okay.
There's actually a good paper by the Academy on like basically like supporting like a well-planned, balanced vegan diet for all age groups. Yeah, they are in support of one that is well planned, not like not the ones that you see on the trending page on YouTube. But a vegan diet that, you know, is balanced, includes a wide variety of food groups, includes fortified foods, includes the necessary supplements. They are definitely in support of. And vegetarianism is a healthful dietary pattern in the dietary guidelines. Which we actually will see updated in 2020. So I'm interested to see if those will contain sustainability measures or anything about sustainability, because the 2015 ones, they had rumors that they were going to, and then, you know, politics.
Are those standards written by a government body?
The dietary guidelines are put out by the USDA every 5 years.
Yeah.
So I was doing my master's in nutrition at Tufts in 2015, and I had professors who like consulted on the dietary guidelines, and they were very upset that any amount of sustainability or anything related to CO2 emissions like did not get included. So we're hopeful on that.
I'm somewhat pessimistic that we won't see it in these dietary guidelines because of the administration that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe 2025, if we're still around, if climate change hasn't burned us all, we'll see them in 2025.
There we go. There's controversial opinions we wanted.
Realistic.
Optimistic.
Going to be a podcast that is truthful above all else, and climate change is a fact, folks.
I think it's just interesting. There's a lot of, because you're saying the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics is in support of a healthy, right, vegan and vegetarian diet. And I think, you know, it's hard sometimes to balance like vegan and vegetarianism with nutrition. Like, for example, like there's a lot of products like Impossible Burger, right? Or Beyond Burger. I don't know if you've tried any of those. Where, you know, they're objectively, they're really, really good if you're focusing on sustainability. They're not particularly nutritious. And not that, like, we need to cut those out, you know, but there are ways, just in general, that there are ways to be vegan and vegetarian that are not healthy.
Yeah. You know? Well, here's the thing, like, you know, and I've seen some, and we love the Impossible Burger. We love the Beyond Burger. My boyfriend and I are both vegan. And I've seen some discussion online now about, is like the soy hemoglobin in the Impossible Burger like actually healthy? Like they did the FDA testing on it, but like, is it? And I'm like, here's the thing. Like, and I say this as like a privileged middle class person. I'm truly like not talking about people who like cannot afford to spend a ton of money on food, but like for people who have the privilege to put an effort into what they think, like you probably shouldn't be having a burger every day no matter what, and that whatever effect that heme ingredient has, like you shouldn't be eating it often enough to have a real effect. And that is for people who eat meat or who don't. Like, don't have a burger every day. You know, if you're eating it that often where you're worried about it, like, but if you eat it like once every few months, I think it's fine, you know?
So here in San Francisco, where these products were sort of developed in this tech startup space, yeah. Right? We have an interesting perspective on it, and that is, I've heard that the plan sort of was not as egalitarian as one would think, but precisely as egalitarian as perhaps it should have been, in that the companies wanted to develop these products so that they could take people who are eating the average American diet, which is unfortunately daily meat, and transform that to be plant-based. I think it's an intermediary step, frankly. And
I don't think their audience is vegans and vegetarians. I don't think that that's their target audience, especially now that they're in all of the fast food restaurants. Right. And I mean, if you're looking at it from a health perspective, these people who may not be able to afford to buy groceries every week and they go to fast food or they don't have the time are going to order a burger no matter what. So like, let's just throw health out the door. Like, they're going to get a burger. So why not make it more sustainable? Like, let's at least focus on one thing, right?
Right.
So I'm in support of that goal. And I think that that is their, I don't really think they care about the vegans and vegetarians eating their burger, because that's such a small percentage of people, at least vegans. I don't know about vegetarians, what percentage they make up in the country.
It's an important piece of marketing. And it is unfortunately a small percent, unfortunate for the environment. Yeah. But I think their goal is to be mass market appealing. And,
yeah.
And who is the mass market right now? That's going to be Meat Eaters. So that's the first step. And I think hopefully in the future we'll be transforming more people into people who eat partially because they care what's in their food. That would be a great dream. Maybe that's what those companies want. Maybe not. But there is certainly an opportunity for this. And I think the science finally got to a place where it could produce this kind of material and make it really edible and scalable. And that really wasn't as possible before, or at least wasn't focused on before. And there wasn't a push for it. But here's the good news. And here is, I think, what you've been a part of with Emily Eats. And that is, we're not going to see products like this without some sort of vocal backlash to all the meat we're eating. So there has to be a push for a vegan option to things. There has to be an active community that's talking about these options, and whether it's sustainability
tell
or
me
health.
Why you're giving me an alternative to meat, because I don't know why if you don't actually tell me. But
There's
if you
no
tell
motivation.
Me that it uses 99% less water, which is something that everyone could be, I literally grew up for 23 years now with my mom telling me, like, clean water is going to be gone and that's going to be the end of the world.
Right.
Like, she is so concerned about water. So, you know, that should be something that we're all thinking about. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
You do have the responsibility to be like, here's the problem with eating so much meat. And so now you see why these products, it's not, I think that that is a more powerful message to people than animals, which, you know, whatever gets them in, whatever gets them to choose the Impossible Burger over the Whopper, you know, a regular Whopper. But I think, you know, if the marketing was like, you're saving a cow, I don't think people would respond to that as well as like, you're saving water, it takes less energy. Like, I think most people are on board with like, we need to be a little bit more conscious. Most people.
If you just asked us a few years ago if we would have been talking in 2019 about fast food restaurants serving popular, completely vegan sustainable burgers, I would have said, what planet are you on?
It's crazy.
That's
I
bizarre.
Had my first Impossible Burger, I can remember. Well, I had my first Beyond Burger my sophomore, because I remember the apartment I was in, my sophomore year of college, so 4 years. Yeah, 4 years ago.
Wow.
And I had my first Impossible Burger in 2018. And now they're in Burger King.
Yep.
I almost said Arby's, but no. Though, okay, can I just make an argument for Arby's? Their tagline is, we have the meats. And if they, like, having an Impossible Burger doesn't, it could fit in so well to their marketing that, like, we have the meats and it's, like, different kind of meat, you know? I don't know. That's a tangent.
But they haven't – they're against tagging.
No, they will never. Yeah. But, Burger King, Carl's Jr., Red Robin. Like, what? That happened in, like, less than 3 years.
I'll have to pull some sources on this and feel free to correct me, Internet. But I believe that a couple of years ago – now ousted CEOs of a couple of fast food companies said, basically, over my dead body, you'll have these vegan options. Those people got replaced. Look what we have now. So there is something happening. The current politics aside, there are people interested in this, and it's a change that finally is happening. I personally think that it's a little strange to have these long-standing, decades-old vanguards of the worst food in the world now serving some of the best food in the world? Question mark.
It is weird, but I think, you know, back to your point, like, they're targeting people that are eating the standard American diet, which is, I would say, probably the majority of the country, like, percentage-wise.
Yes.
So it makes sense from them. You know, like, people want to do what feels good morally, but at the end of the day, they're going to do what the market kind of pushes them to do, or what is more beneficial for them in terms of the market. And that's for customers and the people that are selling the stuff. So if we can use the market to influence, this reminds me of, there's a girl getting her PhD in my research lab, and she does a lot of like behavioral economics, mm-hmm. which is like basically influencing people to make the smarter option. So her study is about, you know, what if kids' meals came with carrot sticks as the default side dish? Like, would kids actually eat carrots? You know, if they actually came, you know, they don't even have to think about, because kids don't really care, like, whatever's in front of them, like, they'll eat. And so it's like, what if the Impossible Whopper was like the default, you know, or it's like the same price, and it's got all of this marketing, and it's got all this positive, like, people are going to be influenced to do that. Like, how do we make it easier for people to make these choices? And yeah, they're just going to get cheaper and cheaper, and they're going to get more easier for people to have access to, which is great.
Yeah, I really agree with the approach that, like, giving someone a default option, like, giving the people the default option of fast food is part of the reason that I think we're in this place, this, like, food crisis. And so I think it can just as easily be reversed if you give people the default option, give people, like, cheap, easy access to healthy food.
Yeah, I guess I do feel a little bit, not torn, but it's just kind of like, you know, as a dietitian, like, I don't want people to go through fast food every day. But at the end of the day, that's what they're going to do until, you know, we see, like, off mic, we were talking about how, you know, as dietitians, I think that we should be talking more about things outside of food, like socioeconomic status, food deserts, etc. But until we have, you know, like, a raise in the minimum wage, or you know, an improvement in the food stamp, they don't call it food stamps anymore, SNAP benefits, you know, until those things happen, like, people are still going to go through fast food. So, like, not that we need to give up, but, like, you can't just, like, go into you can't just have, like, a 4-week program in a low-income community where, like, great, you teach them how to make all these recipes and that's amazing, but, like, are they going to keep that up? I don't know. Yeah. They're definitely going to go through fast food at least sometimes. So, you know, I'm not saying give up, but we have to, like, work on these things outside of exactly what we're eating, and then also have to work with what we've got, which is people going to fast food. And so, like, yeah, having apple slices at McDonald's is great. Is it still McDonald's? Yeah, but at least there's apples, you know?
Yeah, no, Noah and I kind of, we don't totally agree on this, because I think that, I think using the power that those companies have to change so many people's behavior, like, is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and even, you know, even though those companies have a history of, you know, a lot of factory farming and a lot of stuff that's really bad for the environment and, you know, for our health, we do have to use the power that they have. And so I think at least in this way, they're using that power for good.
Yeah. And I do go back and forth with, like, you know, mix everything up and, like, change everything and fix everything, and, like, also just using what we have in our current state. You know, I guess another example that I can think of is, like, Nike, right? You could see it. Nike is, like, a corporate giant, and, like, the just epitome of, like, corporation power greed. But if we push Nike to have better ethical standards, you know, that would be an amazing thing. And have they done some horrible things? Yes. Are they still, like, this giant trillion dollar corporation? Yes. But, like, they have made strides to do, and I'm not saying they have done this, because I don't think they have, because I don't think that they care. but they have done taken strides to do, you know, to produce their products in more ethical standards. And what does that do to all the people below them? Pushes them to do the same to compete with, you know, these new policies they've put in place. So, yeah, I'm both like fix the structures that we have in place, but also like use the structures that we have. I don't know. I guess I'm somewhat of a realist in that way.
At the highest level, I do agree with that. Obviously, what you both just said is a very pragmatic approach to this, and I don't disagree with that level of pragmatism. My response to that, you know, it can always be some hot take and rebuttal on that to say that, oh, corporations are evil, we should be punishing them for this previous bad behavior. My hotter take is, let's examine where the power comes from and why people are driven every day to do a certain behavior, to go and eat at a fast food restaurant. It's not addressing the issue of why it's McDonald's or Burger King, but why is there a food desert there in the first place? Right. Why are there no good options? Why is it so simple to navigate through a grocery store and find unhealthy things, and you have to,
if you have a grocery store,
close right? to you. Why are even in some stores can you not find healthy options? Those are interesting takes. Why even in healthy stores are there unhealthy options still? So there's so many things that deal with at the highest possible level how we have certain choices made. That could deal with subsidies from the government. It could deal with cultural relevance of certain foods and behaviors. I think that's certainly relevant in this country in terms of fast food and eating meat and how just how very American burgers are. Those sorts of larger questions are sometimes even philosophical and harder to solve. But it interests me why people make those choices.
And I think that's the thing. I totally agree with that. That's why I want dietitians to talk more about, like, people can't afford the food that we're recommending. Like, they need to get paid more. They need to stop working 3 jobs so they can actually have time to cook. Like, those are the reasons. It's not that they don't care. It's not that they don't have willpower. They can't. They don't have time, you know? And I think that it's such a disservice to blame it wholly on the person instead of the things in our – that the structures in place to keep them from doing what we are trying to recommend. And yeah, but those conversations seem so overwhelming, right? Like, do we, you know, building grocery stores and making sure that there's not like 15 fast foods around like a high school or something.
Right.
Like, how do we, it's like climate change. Like, those larger conversations seem so overwhelming. So it's like, well, we can replace our light bulbs. Like, that seems really so then, you know, but that's the only people changing their light bulbs are people who are thinking about it. And it's the same thing with food. It's like, oh, well, like, I'll just start buying like brown rice instead of white, like, or just some or beans instead of meat is a good example. Yes.
As far as sustainability. We touched on this earlier. And it's basically once you change the default, people who aren't thinking about it will start making better choices naturally.
Yes.
Once the LED light bulbs are just cheaper and on more shelves, that transition more or less occurred. I think the average person might still run incandescents because of habit and they're still alive after all these years. But
they're truly like not a bad person, but they're like so set in the ways that like I'm not changing I'm doing for the planet. You know, there are people like that.
Sure.
Some people just suck.
Yeah. So. Totally fair.
Or people who like don't even want to try the Impossible Burger because they're like, I would never eat that. And it's like, get out of my face. Like,
right. Words out of my mouth, believe me. Yeah. But once you change the defaults, people will really change their habits.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much thought people put into some things and how little thought gets put into some things.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that's one of our, this touches on one of our major ideas. I think Noah has gotten me a lot more interested in like ethical consumerism in general. Mm-hmm. Like choosing to purchase things from companies that I align with in my values and everything.
Yeah.
But you have to recognize, I mean, and part of the reason I was a little bit against that before is because I see that almost as like as a privilege, you know, almost like elitist. But then if there's not someone to make that change, like if one person makes the change, then, I mean, it starts at the consumer level, right? The change does start at the consumer level.
Mm-hmm.
So like how, I don't know, we talk about like how effective is that, and like you can do that with food or anything.
I do definitely agree with where you're coming from, and it is something that I have prioritized in the last couple years of like first trying to buy things, well, first of all, trying to buy less things and then trying to buy them secondhand. And then if I need to get something new, like, is there a company that's like fair trade or has like ethically rated factory, you know, all these kinds of things. And yeah, it definitely is a privilege to even think about that kind of thing, much less afford those type of product, because they are usually more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't use this phrase because I agree with the economics theory behind it, but I think it is somewhat of a trickle-down effect. Like, people that can afford to buy clothes that are a little bit more expensive, let's say, are still shopping at Target because they like the clothes at Target, but then they decide to switch to, you know, ethically made clothes that might cost a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And so Target loses some market. They are maybe going to be forced to make that a priority of, like, making sure they're the people that are making their clothes and all the crap that they sell are getting paid fairly. So I hope that the companies that are doing the right thing as far as like producing ethical products will lead to change in other companies. But it is kind of weird because it's like, you know, it's a bunch of middle class, upper class people like buying mm-hmm. ethically made things, and then we're running around saying like, oh, like make sure like what you're buying is like ethically made, and it's like you're telling this to people who can't afford it, and it's like, shut up. You know, like I can't do that, you know.
Yeah, I mean that's my issue with it, but I guess right, as long as you, I mean, I do think it does have power, so I guess it's just mm-hmm. sort of about not preaching it to people that can't afford it.
And it does have power, because at the end of the day, someone made the thing that you have, and at least you know that someone got paid fairly and is treated better than the person in the Nike factory, you know. So mm-hmm. while, yeah, I guess you could think about it as far as like, does this have like power as far as like capitalism in the market, isn't this changing thing, it's like, well, you at least like helped one person like not get their finger cut off in the factory, you know.
Beyond that, I mean, I we think we mentioned this a bit earlier with the social influence of veganism. It doesn't take as many people as one would think to start mm-hmm. a change, start a movement of some kind. And you're going to get notoriety, good notoriety in a way, by making these sorts of headlines, by saying, mm-hmm. we refuse. A protest with 20 people that's loud enough outside a Target can get local news attention, and on a slow news day, get more attention. I mean, mm-hmm. this is sort of how anything adapts. Sometimes it's pointless, sometimes it's misguided, but if they are ethically or sustainability aligned, those kinds of choices we make every day can have a huge outsized impact, which is beneficial to everyone.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that the people who are pushing for the, like, who were preaching the Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger were, like, vegans and vegetarians, which is definitely like less than 1% of the population. Sure. But look at all the fast food restaurants that we have at now, you know. And yeah, there were some meat eaters thrown in there that were singing its praises, but who are the first people talking about it? Not a lot of people in the grand scheme of things.
That's right. In a very strange way, it was that 1% of people who ended up having an outsized impact, and now we have vegan burgers, vegan sustainable burgers in fast food restaurants. It's hard to even say that.
But it is so great that now when we go on road trips, I can get something at a fast food restaurant that has some protein. And I'm definitely not one to like harp on protein all the time. Like I'm positive we get enough. Like that's the one thing that all Americans get enough of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But like as a vegan, when you're traveling, it's really hard to find something that has a decent amount of protein to keep you full. It's usually like, you know, you go to Subway and you get like a veggie sandwich, which is like, okay, I'm having vegetables on bread with avocado. But oh my God, I can get a burger at a restaurant. Like I can like feel satisfied after a meal while I'm traveling. It's great.
So, I mean, okay. In general, we keep mentioning a thing that I think we need to define, and that is sustainability. So something that we've been doing and we'll keep doing is sort of to ask everyone that we talk to, what that term means to them and what they think it should mean, because it's going to have a bigger and bigger impact. We think we are some of those small voices starting out now, and mm-hmm. we need to determine why we're using this word and why we're thinking about food and consumerism and our own behavior every day in context with it.
Yeah. I guess I've never really thought about the definition of meme, but I guess sustainability to me is leaving as little an impact on the world and the planet as possible.
Completely valid. And yeah. that's honestly, I think, part of the dictionary definition. It's about
very good definition.
Absolutely. It's about the cycles that we engage in and the things we consume, and in a sustainable cycle, you don't consume more than the planet can possibly reproduce, right? So there's this continual process of we're using resources that we can keep using, basically, and we have the ability to keep doing that, and it's a system that if everyone kept doing it, would keep working. That's sort of the whole point. You can have sustainable supply chains, sustainable burgers, sustainable clothing. Mm-hmm. It's all possible, but I think that's a huge piece of it.
Yeah, and it is a really broad term, but we think it's a powerful term. So.
Yeah, my thesis is going to be related to sustainability and, like, university dining services, so I'm probably going to have to, like, dive into a bunch of research on, like, what is sustainability, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm sure I will learn much more about it than I do now, which I feel like I know a good amount about it, but I'll have to read a bunch of research articles on sustainability and how is it defined. And, you know, of course we don't have one definition of it.
No. And we can, in some ways we can make our own definition of it. Hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully.
Yes.
That's part of what these conversations are about. That's part of what these sorts of businesses are about. It's trying to act in a way that is every bit as human and fun and delicious as we want it to be, but is also hopefully something that every human could do, and we still have a planet at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Crazy goal, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I would say we would agree, right, that veganism and vegetarianism are sustainable, one type of sustainable eating patterns.
Right.
Not
right.
the only type, but one type of those things. So.
Yeah, it's a type of sustainable eating pattern, and it's a way that you can live more sustainably in your daily life, right? Like you said, we eat three plus times a day. You know, there's really nothing else that we do so often. So how can we, and you don't even have to define yourself as a vegan or vegetarian. Like, you know, if you are trying to prioritize plant-based meals and snacks, then you are in a very major part of your life, like living more sustainably.
I think we might have a sense about this, but I wonder if for the audience at home, you might speak a bit about why you're vegan versus vegetarian.
Yeah, I think my freshman year of college, I was in a dorm, and that was when, it was kind of like my senior year. I got into like all the blogs and started reading and kind of got into like the real food movement. And I had always eaten pretty healthy. Like my mom cooked almost every meal. Like we were not a fast food family. We were not like an eating out family, mostly because we couldn't afford it. And you know, she made us breakfast every morning, and we were by no means vegan or vegetarian, but we had like a plethora of fruits and vegetables and beans and rice, which another tangent. I think the basis of the idea that like meat is such a central part to like cultural diets is kind of BS in a way. Like I think the bulk of most cultures' diets is plants. Like even like Southern Cajun, you know, what people think of as like so meat heavy, like Cajuns were always poor. They could not, they used what they hunted, but then most of what they ate was like beans and rice. Like the basis of most Cajun recipes is beans and rice and vegetables. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, it is like, it is these modern versions that we've added so much shit to, but you know, they were mostly plants anyway. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of beans and rice and vegetables and fruits. And, you know, I was taking like whole wheat bread sandwiches to school before whole wheat bread was cool. So we always ate pretty healthy, but my senior year of high school, I got into like the real food blogs and got really into that and, you know, cut out like processed foods and like stuff with less than 5 ingredients, all that, like, you know, all those kind of things. And that was like when Food Babe was really popular. I don't know if you know who Food Babe is. She's kind of like a, oh, she's interesting. But so when I went into college, I was living in a dorm my freshman year, and I like didn't want to eat the meat that was in the dining hall because I was like, I don't want to eat like commercial meat. Like, I don't want to support like factory farming, but I wasn't like anti-meat at that point. And so I just accidentally became vegetarian, I think. Like, I just didn't want to eat. But, and I didn't have anywhere to cook organic meat. And like, guess what? A freshman college student could not afford that anyway. So I was just buying like organic eggs or something and cheese every now and then eating, I guess, kind of vegan other than that. And then I watched, the summer after my freshman year, I watched Cowspiracy at the beginning of the summer. And then I went vegan the next day. And I've been vegan ever since. So it was like an accidental way into vegetarianism. And I would eat like fish or maybe meat when I would go out to eat or something, like as a treat. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't ever really like a super conscious decision. And then it was when I watched Cowspiracy and really thought about it, that was like, why am I eating animals? Like, I love animals. I don't, like, I was brought up like to live very sustainably. Like, my mom is like such a hippie. She's got like a recycling symbol tattoo. Like, we were doing all the things like my whole life. So I was like, this doesn't like compute with like what I say that I value. So yeah, that was in June of 2015.
Yeah, so, that's a great, yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I am naturally a very extreme person, so I will say like I wanted to take it all the way. And you know, I'm sure that came from a place of like perfectionism as well, and maybe some like wanting to be a little bit restrictive, maybe like subconsciously. But that didn't really show up until a little bit later. Yeah, but then I think as I have gotten more mature as a vegan, yeah, I'm not interested in harming animals for things that I personally don't need. I'm like, if I'm one person and I don't need these things, and that's fine. And maybe it'll make up for one person who like can't afford to go vegan or like doesn't have the effort, you know? So I'm like, I will take it to the extreme so that someone else doesn't have to, because I don't think everyone's going to go vegan, you know?
Yeah. I like that thought. I've never thought about it that way. That I like that, you know, going vegan for someone that maybe can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't and have I, the privilege. I just, at this point, like I don't think, never in my 4 years as a vegan have I been like, I want to eat eggs or fish or cheese. Like, it just is not something that has interested me. So I never had to like dive into those deep feelings of like, but I really want this thing. It just has actually been pretty easy, minus the like borderline eating disorder. But that happens when you're vegan or not.
Right, it will pop
up. Regardless of your diet, if you and I mean diet in that way as like your food pattern, it will pop up. It does not discriminate.
Mm-hmm. Of course, and I think it's about having both the access, but the idea that you're not losing anything. We talk about this a lot with what we purchase and the food we're trying to eat, and why we particularly aren't vegan, but. The fact that you don't want to not be is important. And when people feel like they aren't being pressured to do something, but that they can losslessly just enjoy their lives normally, and it's not an extra behavior, that's what's going to change a system and change something.
It doesn't like affect my life on a daily basis.
Right.
Like, I don't have to make any extra effort. And I will say, like, I have had incredible support from family and friends. Like, my mom is vegan. Now my boyfriend is vegan, which was totally his decision. Wow. And, you know, my friends have been supportive. People in dietetics and nutrition have been supportive. So I've had a lot of support, and I do have a lot of privilege because I am able to afford, like, you know, some Beyond Burgers when we want to cook those at home so that we don't feel like we're missing out. But yeah, it could be hard to be vegan and feel like you're not missing out if you can't afford those specialty items for when you do want like something that you had when you were not vegan, you know. And at that point, it's like, I would rather someone who can't afford to buy, I don't know, like a $6 box of like vegan mac and cheese to like just, I think I would just rather them get Kraft and like call it a day. Like they wanted some mac and cheese, they got it, whatever, because they couldn't afford the vegan version, and then go about their lives normally, like as eating vegan, you know? Like that, because then you get stuck in that like restrictive spot of like, well, now I, you know, I can't have like the vegan mac and cheese, but I want the mac, and then, you know, so.
Yeah.
I think people being 90% vegan is always going to be more beneficial than not trying at all. So
I think I haven't listened to as many of these as I should, but when people in positions of power in government and large companies even talk about transforming these types of food systems, it's always in this very clever, I think, frankly, from a marketing perspective, quite clever perspective, which is we need to basically get people to change very, very, very slowly. So stop eating meat one day a week, right? Have a vegan lunch a couple days a week. Do something that changes the behavior without losing out on any one particular thing at all. Continue to do what you want. That's why there are cheat days in workout routines, right? So when you have that built in, people are much more likely to keep with a system instead of one that restricts everything. So that's a great perspective.
Yeah, and it's the same thing when it comes to like being a dietitian and like teaching people nutrition. It's like, you know, let's start with breakfast. Like what meal do you care the least about? Mm-hmm. Like let's start with that one. And like let's see what things that we can switch. Are you eating a bagel for breakfast? Great. Why don't we switch it to a whole grain bagel? And then we'll do that for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then we'll swap something else that you like don't, you aren't so attached to. Like let's start with the easiest things for you to change, and let's do it really slowly so that you get used to it, and then this becomes your new routine. Like buying the whole grain bagels is just like what you do now.
Yeah, that's
and it's the same thing with like trying to eat more sustainably and more in line with like plant-based.
It only takes about 90 days to form habits.
Yeah,
I've heard less than that.
Or sure, yeah.
We don't actually know.
As I say, statistics here. It's amazingly quick, but it's certainly true that most people can't change a thing in their lives every day for 90 days.
Right.
It's really hard.
Habitual creatures.
Yeah. It's hard regardless. And then it's hard when you have a job and maybe you have kids and maybe you have other things that you take care of and you have a social life. Like most people, like I think most people don't think about food as much as we think. People are just so busy and just trying to get on with their days that either food is an afterthought or food is a comfort from all of the other shit that they've got going on. Like people don't think about food as much as we think, like as much as probably we do, you know?
Yeah. We think a lot about it, but there's so much so many other things to worry about.
And people are still interacting with food though. That is, I think the crux of the problem and why we're interested in talking about it is because people are, they're putting some thought into it. They have to be the ones who pick the thing out from the grocery store shelf.
And that could be a detriment, right? They're not thinking about it so much, so they are just grabbing something in a hurry, or they are just like grazing all day on stuff that is just laying around, and they're not actually taking the time to sit down for a meal. So while I think it can be a benefit to like behavior change and that they're not so attached to what they're eating, like it might be easier to change out some things because they want a meal. Like it doesn't matter what it is. It is hard because they're just trying to get on with their day and they don't have much time to think about it.
Yeah, and I think that goes into the idea that perhaps we need to change people's days instead of trying to force them to change their eating habits first. But given all these situations, there are certainly applications where changing what you eat can make your day better, or making a modification somewhere in a system where, let's say, a person listening to this podcast is responsible for purchasing food in an office, they can change by virtue of the default state in their office. They can change what a lot of people are eating, and they can change that grazing behavior, right?
Right.
So it's little impacts that can go quite a long way.
Right. And it's like with kids, you know, I don't think kids care so much about what's on their plate. I think it's more like social pressure. But who's making those decisions about what food is served in school? Because, like, if everyone is getting the same thing, I think that kids would eat it. When everyone has, like, a healthier meal, then it becomes, like, the social norm to eat it. So, like, that one person is ordering food for that whole school district. They can make the choice to change what food is on the kids' plate. And they, frankly, I don't think really care, especially younger kids.
Well, to them, it might be an economics issue. If they could save two pennies with another option, they would immediately care. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's so then how do you change that person's perspective? Well, then you have to go somewhere up the line and adjust food subsidies given to who's growing corn and soy. And those little tiny adaptations can, again, have a large impact.
Yeah.
Ooh, so many big things to talk about, because, like, my gut reaction to that was just, like, about to say, because we always talk about, like, beef subsidies, and we're like, well, just take away the beef subsidies and let people understand how expensive a burger really is. But then you forget all the people who, like, live on burgers because that's all they can afford. And then you forget about the farmers who, you know, maybe that's been in their families, and I'm not, you know, they're not bad people. Like, that, they're just getting by, right? So we need to provide them with alternatives for what they can do as jobs, right?
Exactly.
Like, this is way higher up than just, like, switch everything to the Impossible Burger, you know?
Yeah.
There were people to think about. I always think about this with, like, I'm from South Louisiana. My dad works in oil. My grandpa worked in oil. Everyone works in oil in some way. That is how the towns in South Louisiana get by. And, you know, when oil's doing good, oil is a little bit more expensive, but at least everyone is doing well. There are more places opening up. Like, when I go home, like, I can tell how the oil industry is by, like, what the town looks like.
Wow.
And when oil is not doing well, because it dips, like, every 5 years, you know, things have closed. It's a little bit quieter, but gas is cheaper at least. But people are out of a job. And, you know, I always, of course, I, like, don't want to drill any more oil. Like, I'm totally on board with that. But I'm like, I know so many people who would be out of a job if we just said no more oil tomorrow. So, like, what are you going to do for, you know, the people in South Louisiana who have done oil for 100 years? You know, like my dad.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I have a personal connection to that. But I think we talk about coal a lot, and I'm like, I don't think that we have as many jobs in coal as we do oil. Can we talk about that? Like, what are we going to do for those people in order to make, like, a switch that benefits everyone?
Nothing is as simple as it seems, you know?
No, definitely not. It seems really, really simple to just say, let's build some windmills, but it is not that simple.
It's about changing incentive structures, right? So it's not just what governments or what large companies or farmers or oil workers are incentivized to do. It's about what people are incentivized to do. And so when you change the motivational structure, people will change their default behaviors. Every organization is a set of people making decisions every single day. So when we change incentive structures, we're just adjusting what a couple of people prioritize. And that has huge, huge down the line impacts.
Yeah.
Most of the big changes in the world don't totally undermine the previous thing that came before them. They slowly, slowly adapt to it. And by the time that we see a big change being made, it's happened very, very slowly, and we've seen smaller things happen very, very slowly. That's the good news. I think there are things that are changing, and it isn't that an industry is going to be wiped out overnight, but the ones that are most resistive to small, slow, gradual adaptations will have a much harder time.
Yeah. Oil.
Yeah.
It's all
not really budging.
Oil and gas. Yeah.
They're really holding on, aren't they? And it's transport, it's our food systems, it's petrochemical pesticides. Yeah.
Meanwhile, Tyson has, like, a plant-based line of like, they're not vegan, which I'm kind of pissed about. Like, they have egg whites in them, which I'm like, you know what? Screw you. Like, I'm not sure if I can curse on this podcast, so I'm trying to keep.
You can. It's fine.
We don't care.
But I'm like, I know, again, I know your target market is not vegans, but like, can you please, like, I just want a good chicken nugget, man. Ugh, I was mad. But like, that's incredible that Tyson is exploring that, you know? So I'd like to see other companies doing that, or other industries doing like the same thing.
Right. And they should be. I think they're quickly seeing in the food world that motivation and that incentive structure shifting. It'll take a little longer in the energy world. But I mean, in this country, electric cars are, what, 1-3% of all cars sold. In some countries, it's 30-40%. So we're at a place where we're ready to make these sorts of changes. And not everywhere has as much meat in its cultural diet. So it's not like you can't have a large country that is largely vegetarian or vegan. That is possible, right?
Yeah. But it's we are negatively influencing the rest of the world slowly. So if we could kind of switch and kind of halt that trend, that would be great.
That sounds terrible. That's actually a great point in that American people, or certainly Western world people, have a huge influence on world culture. And so the patterns and the motivations and incentives that we adopt become world patterns and world incentives. So the things that we talk about on our internet, our podcasts, our videos end up being sort of world culture. So we've got to be leaders in this. It's not just scary. You're influencing your friends, you're, especially online, influencing other nations.
Yeah, which is scary. I'm scared that America is becoming the example, because we definitely do not have the healthiest or healthiest as far as like food wise, but also we are like always running around stressed, and we don't have the best culture. So I don't like that we are I think that there are much more like chill countries who have like lower levels of stress that should be the world example, not
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we agree with that. Well, thank you so much. We don't want to take up any more of your time. Thank you. We really appreciate you being on and your opinions. We really enjoyed having you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I know your blog's already doing pretty well, but if you want to tell people where to find you.
I will plug it anytime. the blog is emilyeats.com. Emily is E-M-I-L-I-E. And I'm Emily Eats everywhere on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, Twitter. You can email me at emily@emilyeats.com. That's about it.
Fantastic. You got all the right social media handles. Very lucky these days.
Thank you.
This has been an amazing podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.